responsible to set our life on the right track. And this country does need a little bit of that. We need a little paddling. I mean, I was a problem child growing up, and it took a good leadership to set me straight. So I think our country does need some of that. So I hands down believe people wanted it 4 years ago, 3 years ago. So,
but they didn't vote that way, right?
I don't know about that.
You think it was a stolen election?
Without a doubt.
Donald Trump said on his first day he's going to be a dictator for a day.
I like that. Yeah, I like that.
Would you rather have Donald Trump as a dictator for 4 years or reelect Joe Biden for 4 years?
I would rather have Donald Trump. I'd like them to see the repeal of the Roosevelt law so that he can be a president for a lot more than 4 years. But this country needs a dictator. I hate to say that, but it's the truth.
Donald Trump said in a speech that on day one, for a day, he would be a dictator. What do you think of that?
No idea. I don't know.
Would you rather have 4 years of Donald Trump as a dictator or 4 years of Joe Biden as a president?
Trump.
As a dictator?
Maybe.
Would you rather have four
okay,
years
we get of it. We get Donald it. Trump? We get it. The MAGA brains. Do you think those people actually know what's going on? Look, that farmer did a really great job yesterday explaining the 40 years. The 40 years of conservative talk, right-wing radio, conservative media, just pumping it into people's minds that you can't trust the mainstream media, that the Democrats are devils and feeding misinformation, and now it's an echo chamber, and now it has all come together, and that's how Donald Trump gets elected. From misinformation and, quite frankly, from ignorance. And people don't know that they're being manipulated. And so they end up like that in America, which is a democracy, saying that they're okay with a dictator and that he should be able to run more than twice, that he should serve more than two terms, which means getting rid of the Constitution. And so when people like me tell you the truth that that's not what our Constitution says, we should never want a dictatorship, then they make you think that I'm somehow giving misinformation because they are brainwashed and it is a cult. It is a cult. That's why whoever just said in the chat, he loves the poorly educated, because the rich folks, they know. The rich folks support him because he's making them richer. They're paying fewer taxes, less taxes than what? Than the poor in this country. Than the poor in this country. Percentage-wise, they're paying less. Now, you would think a billionaire who has ample, just, you know what they say when people say F you money, don't you think they should be paying more, even percentage-wise? Because they have more to give. They have more disposable income. They can buy, look, if you have enough money to buy one plane, one private jet, then you should be paying more. If you have enough to buy more than one, then you should be paying more. I mean, why? How much do you need? But those folks, they know the real deal because they're smart. They know I'm voting for this man because of my taxes. In the meantime, you're fighting about social issues and DEI that you don't even know the definition of. You don't even understand the definition of DEI. You don't understand that it helps veterans, that it helps disabled people, that it helps women. You don't understand that. Just little things like things where a woman can go into a private room and breastfeed and or pump milk, or any of those things. Or veterans have equal access to the job market. Or disabled people can get a ramp so that they can get to work. Just little things. And you think it's all because, like, you think it's about black people who are not deserving of your jobs, who are less qualified than you. And they're stealing your jobs. That's what you think it is. That's what they want you to think it is. because they want to keep you fighting. And you have fallen for it with your stupid MAGA brain. Because you are in a cult and it makes you feel like you belong to something. It makes you feel, you're welcome, Nicole Luongo. Thank you for mentioning disabled people like me. And anyone else who knows who other, what DEI does, who it actually helps, put it in the chat and we'll educate you. But because you want to belong to something. It makes you feel like you're part of the club. They don't care about anything other than the ability to be hateful, says Brittany Essa. In the meantime, Donald Trump is still going around saying that the election results are not true, even though he won. He still doesn't believe that they're true, except for him. So if the election results are not true, then maybe he actually did not get the votes. Maybe folks are right. They're saying that Elon Musk tampered. That's what people are saying, right? You've heard it. That there was some tampering with the votes electronically. Well, this is what he said in an interview. Listen, I want you to listen closely and tell me if this makes sense.
They really do. You won the popular vote. You won all the swing states. But still, Kamala Harris got 75 million votes in the country.
Well, if you believe the whole thing.
Yeah,
the,
okay. Let's just say.
It is ridiculous.
That the election was as it was.
Excuse me. There are seven swing states. I won them all.
You did.
By a lot.
But let me just get to the dismount here.
And I won the popular.
Have you thought about how to try to bring the country together, to reach out or to find common ground? Have you thought about that? Or
can you imagine how tiny this person's self-esteem is? To always be so constantly obsessed with numbers and who got the most or whatever. So if it was not accurate, then perhaps his votes are not accurate. So what he's saying doesn't make sense. So shouldn't he be saying like, look, yeah, I won fair and square. This is a free and fair election, but yet and still he just can't admit it. That the election was within 1% or whatever, a very tiny percentage of the vote. He will tell you it's a mandated landslide. It was not a landslide. So Donald Trump is still lying to people. Still lying. Putting us into a what? Right now, we are in a constitutional crisis, and I have been telling you this, and it's all based on lies and that Donald Trump and this administration, they don't give a damn about the Constitution. Neither do they care about the rule of law. I think Democrats have finally gotten it, but I think it may be a little bit too late because there's not much that they can do. Elizabeth Warren.
Isn't actually the guy who puts in the orders and cuts people's paychecks. There's somebody else in the system who does that. And they're a click down from Donald Trump and a click down from that and a click down from that. And when a federal court issues an order and then gets people in front of them and says, you either follow that order or find yourself in contempt. Now we're going to see whether or not those are people who are going to say, oh, but Donald Trump told me. And a judge is going to say, I don't care what Donald Trump told you. Yeah. I'm telling you what the law is. You follow the law. And, you know, my view right now is the courts are where we are hanging on to our constitutional structure. They still have the power to hold everybody else in this country in contempt if they do not follow lawfully issued court orders.
Except, Elizabeth Warren, maybe in a state court, and that will hold true, but not in federal court where most of this will take place. They are really immune. There are no consequences. I hate to be Donnie Downer, but let me just tell you, Donald Trump will say, I'm acting in the official capacity as president. The Supreme Court granted me that right. And if you prosecute anyone that I give orders to, I'm just going to pardon them. And they are not going to suffer any consequences. And I'm going to bring them back and I'm going to keep them in the government. That, my dears, that is a constitutional crisis. And we are in one right now. So what do we do? I don't know. Elizabeth Warren is hanging her hat on the courts. good luck. Because we see what happens with the courts now. You know what's happening with the courts? Governor Rod Blagojevich. All of it wiped away. Donald Trump pardoned him. I believe it's a pardon, right? Am I correct, producers? It's a pardon. Eric Adams. Donald Trump's Justice Department has ordered the courts in New York, the federal courts, to drop all of the charges against who? Eric Adams. Department of Justice. Can we call the Department of Justice? Someone says in the chat, you can call them. I don't know if it's going to make a difference. I'm just being honest with you guys. I don't know. And here's something else that will happen. Because there's breaking news coming out. It says Steve Bannon pleads guilty in New York. We build a wall case. So you remember that whole case with Steve Bannon? Where they said that it was fraudulent. He actually served time. Steve Bannon, a longtime ally of President Donald Trump, pleaded guilty on Tuesday on a fraud charge in a case alleging he helped defraud donors who were giving money to build a wall at the U.S. border. Southern U.S. border. In exchange for a guilty plea, he agreed to a conditional discharge and waived his right to appeal. Bannon was sentenced to 3 years conditional discharge. He will not be allowed to serve as an officer or a director of a charity or any charitable organization in New York State or any fundraising or not-for-profit organization in New York State. This is state court. So Donald Trump doesn't have jurisdiction. He will not be allowed to receive or hold assets for any charitable organizations. He was originally charged in an indictment with 6 counts of money laundering, conspiracy, and a scheme to defraud. So Steve Bannon in state court couldn't save him from that. So maybe in these state courts, Elizabeth Warren is right. But in the federal court, nope, they are lawless. Dorothy Taylor. Dorothy, why aren't you a member? You should be a member. Eric Adams will now kiss his boots and ring as well. So Eric Adams, not suffering any consequences. Rod Blagojevich, he's already paid somewhat because he went to jail. Because he went to jail. George Conway, you guys know George Conway, Kellyanne Conway's ex-husband, who is a never-Trumper, has never liked Donald Trump. Even when his wife was trying to elect him, he was quiet then back during the campaign. And then afterwards, he's like, I've had enough of this. And then they got a divorce. Here's George Conway talking about the constitutional crisis and what the courts should be doing and are not. Here it is.
This is, you know, the only recourse will be for people to get out and say, we want the rule of law. We want a government that obeys the law.
Pause.
And that's going to require people to go out.
Did you guys hear what I said yesterday and I've been saying all along? That you need to take it to the streets? Sounds like George Conway is saying exactly what we said. Let's hear him out. Here it is.
That's going to require people to go out on the streets because there is no other alternative. It's telling us something that we should have already known. And last week I said it. They are not going to obey court orders. They have decided that they are going to push the boundaries on executive power by basically infringing on the Article 1 power of Congress. And they are violating the Constitution, the text of the Constitution in the birthright citizenship issue. They are violating the text of statutes by having DOGE run around and do all the things that have been doing the executive orders. There's no reason that this government that has decided not to obey the laws and the Constitution of the United States is going to obey a court order. And as you know, Joe, having practiced law, there's really only one way that courts can enforce their orders when somebody is being contumacious or refusing to obey an order. And that's to send the U.S. Marshals out to take somebody in and to hold them into contempt or to otherwise enforce court orders. Well, who does the U.S. Marshals Service work for?
Yep.
The U.S. Marshals Service is part of the United States Department of Justice. It reports to Donald J. Trump.
Pause. Now, I have not heard this entire thing. I have not spoken to George Conway. George Conway is saying exactly what I've been saying. Constitutional crisis, there is no recourse. Perhaps in the state courts, people are too afraid to make sacrifices, says Kev, the creator. Yes, they are. But you got to make sacrifices. You're going to take to the streets. Maybe you don't care about your democracy. I don't know. Maybe you don't care about your son or your daughter or your husband or whatever facing the consequences of doing something that you think is not, you know, not such a big deal. Perhaps they were wrong, but they because they made a mistake. But yet, your relative, your friend, your neighbor, your loved one is going to be bogged down in the court. You're going to get caught up in the system and going to have to pay the consequences, suffer the consequences. In the meantime, the folks who are really committing the big treasonous crimes against the country, they are going to get off scot-free. They are ruining our democracy. Let's listen. George is saying what I'm saying. Let's keep listening to George.
What's going to happen here, mark my words, is that at some point, they are going to basically tell the United States Marshal Service, do not enforce any of these orders. We will not obey them, mm-hmm. and you are not to enforce them. And once that happens, I hope it doesn't happen, but I know in my heart that it will. Our 236-year experiment in the federal rule of law, in democratic self-governance for the United States of America, in American constitutionalism, is essentially over. The courts have no mechanism to enforce their orders other than through the United States Marshal Service.
Yeah.
And thus through the Department of Justice, thus through the executive branch. The reason why we obey court orders is because the executive branch complies with court orders. If the executive branch does not comply with court orders and makes a point of saying that we will not comply with court orders, the rule of law, in as far as the federal government is concerned, is over. And that is something we need to start focusing on and discussing, because that's where these people will go. There is no logical stopping point for them.
Stop. Did you guys hear that? I've been saying that all along. Now, he broke it down as it relates to the U.S. Marshal Service. It's over. We are in a constitutional crisis. Donald Trump is a dictator. Donald Trump can basically do what he wants. I'm sorry. I know that you guys don't like to hear that unless you take to the streets and you start fighting back. They start fighting back in the courts. Yeah, Amanda Belcher, Jesus Christ, this is legit. This is terrifying. I've been trying to tell you guys that. I told you I'm not going to bombard you with stuff that it's not important. But when it comes to these issues as it relates to the law, that's the stuff I keep bringing you, because that's the important stuff I'm trying to tell you. He can do, I know it's hard to hear. He can do whatever he wants to. And the people around him can do whatever they want to. You heard Elizabeth Warren and others. I think George Conway may have mentioned Doge. You guys know who Sam Altman is, right? Sam Altman also has this OpenAI thing, and he's sort of in competition with Elon Musk. He knows Elon Musk. They're both in Silicon Valley. He had a few choice words to say about Elon Musk in an interview that he did. Here's Sam Altman.
Sam, of course, the headlines right now, Elon Musk making a bid
apparently
for OpenAI. Your response, you're turning him down for $97
billion. I mean, look, OpenAI is not for sale. The OpenAI mission is not for sale. Elon tries all sorts of things for a long time. This is the late, you know, this week's episode.
You take it seriously at all? What do you think he's trying to drive at with this?
I think he's probably just trying to slow us down. He obviously is a competitor. It's, you know, he's working hard and he's raised a lot of money for XAI, and they're trying to compete with us from a technological perspective, from, you know, getting the product into the market. And I wish he would just compete by building a better product, but I think there's been a lot of tactics, you know, many, many lawsuits, all sorts of other crazy stuff, now this. And we'll try to just put our head down and keep working.
Does it make it more difficult to move from that non-profit model to that for-profit model for OpenAI?
We're not moving to a for-profit model. We're not sure we're going to do it all, but no matter what, the nonprofit will continue to be extremely important. It will drive the mission. It will continue to exist. The board is looking at lots of options about how to best structure for this next phase, but the nonprofit is not changing into anything or going anywhere.
Okay. What is your main mission here at the Paris AI Action Summit. You got Stargate. There's question marks about how much you're actually going to commit to that. Maybe you can give us some numbers on that, Sam. What is the messaging here from you and the team?
So I've been to an earlier version of this at Bletchley Park, and that one was more focused on safety. This one, people are still talking about safety, but really I think people are now saying, okay, this technology is here. It's having an incredible impact. We've got to drive it. There is a lot of questions about how people can, you know, maybe the most common question I've gotten is, can you do a Stargate in my country? You know, we need infrastructure here. We want to do this. Can you help? So that's been a common one. But a lot of other things about just how are we going to deploy this technology to make sure people benefit? Where's it going to go? You know, in what ways is the model going to improve? Last week, we launched this thing called Deep Research. There's been a ton of questions about that. You know, how can we use this to really drive economic growth? But yeah, maybe economic growth has been the single biggest theme here.
And have you had clarity on DeepSeek? I know you and the team have been looking into that, whether they distilled, whether they inappropriately used your inferencing data. Have you had more clarity on that?
I mean, whether they did or didn't,
they
built a good model. Many people will distill from many other models. Again, I feel so confident about our research roadmap and also our product roadmap that, you know, DeepSeek will do whatever DeepSeek's going to do. Other people do whatever they're going to do. And we're just going to try to, like, build the best technology we can and get into people's hands. And I think that's mostly going pretty well.
Do you think Musk's approach then is from a position of insecurity about XAI?
Probably his whole life is from a position of insecurity. I feel for the guy.
You feel for him?
I do, actually. I don't think he's like a happy person. I do feel for him.
Okay. Do you worry that he has this proximity to the president and he can influence the decision making of the U.S. presidency and policies around this agenda on AI?
Not particularly. Maybe I should, but not particularly. I mean, I try to just wake up and think about like how we're going to make our technology better.
Okay. Sam Altman.
Sam Altman. I like Sam Altman. He's good. He's good. I actually met him once I was getting an award in San Francisco. And my friend was like, I was like, you know what? I was in Florida and I was asking a friend that we were having lunch with. I said, can you get me in touch with Sam Altman? I'd like to get him on the show. And he said, Don, you sat next to him for an hour when you got the award in San Francisco. And I went, oh my gosh, I totally forgot. And I already had his phone number in my thing. And so I want to get Sam Altman on the show. So guys, help me. If you know, email Sam Altman, tell him to come on the show. But Sam Altman is saying he thinks that he is a deeply unhappy person. And that's a person who is leading the charge as it relates to what happens economically in our country, at least with saving money and trying to, you know, get rid of so-called government overspending. Jen Psaki has, do you guys know who Jack Schlossberg is? The nephew of Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Caroline Kennedy's son. He was on with Jen Psaki, and I just want to play this. He and Jen Psaki had a fascinating conversation. We'll play a little bit of it, but he's talking about what's going on in the country, and he's out there. If you haven't seen him, go out, look on social media for Jack Schlossberg, but here he is.
What have you found, either from your own experimentation with playing around with social media platforms, or even just from listening to and consuming the products of some of the people you may totally disagree with, works?
Yeah, I mean, I have like a few thoughts. I think one is the internet is like a nuanced destruction machine, and so there's no room for qualifying anything ever. Don't waste your time. If you're going to tweet something out, like make it so extreme that you can't, that it's completely, that's what Trump does. It's like a completely clear statement. Take it all the way. And that's the only thing that really resonates online, because everything else, it's too confusing otherwise. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is you have to be controversial or unexpected. So you have to be very clear and you have to be very controversial in order to break through, I think. And conservatives are good at playing with that without getting in trouble. And I don't know that we've come up with our own style of being funny and taking risks. And people talk a lot about how Democrats lost young men in this election. And I think a huge part of that is like, not because we focus on the wrong policies, but because we seem so risk averse and we seem so cautious. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I don't think that in general, young men find that as attractive as a more risk on kind of say whatever you want attitude.
Okay, so it's not just young men. I think it's more than young men. I think it's a lot of folks don't like that they're too scared, that they're too risk averse. A lot of folks don't like it. And that's part of the reason why Democrats lost, because they're too nervous and buttoned up. And another reason I believe that why many people are turning away from politics is because there are no people, there are very few people who are like Jack Salzberg. He's not in politics, but he comes from a political family. There should be more people like Jasmine Crockett, or there should be more people like AOC or Maxwell Frost or any of the younger folks who are in Washington. That people don't know when to step down, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, remember? Like Joe Biden. Like Mitch McConnell. Like Dianne Feinstein. They just don't know, like, hey, it's time. And they stay in longer than they should. And they block people from coming in who can really make a difference. Now, I'm going to play this because I feel sorry for them. But, you know, this person had a medical episode. But this is some of the reason why people are saying, hey, look, know when it's time. And just get some younger folks in there. But, again, we hope that this gentleman is okay. It's sad because it happened to Mitch McConnell. It happened to Dianne Feinstein. It happened to a couple of people when they were in politics. And I just want to, you know, this is just an example of, you know, term limits. Here it is.
Don't worry, no one on the Republican side in the House and Senate who control both the House and Senate is going to speak up and challenge us . But we need to protect Americans' privacy and their social security. For 40% of all Americans, social security is the basis for their retirement and their retirement savings. And for 28 million Americans, Social Security is the only thing that they have. And that's why we have to make sure that we are protecting it as well.
So I saw a couple of people with their comments up on the screen. Why was no one helping him? That's what I don't understand either. And why didn't someone like walk up and stand next to him and say, you know, representative, let's, you know. Do you know what I'm saying? Now, I'm not being an ageist or anything. I'm just saying that there's time. Sometimes you got to know when it's time. Am I wrong? And I don't know why term limits would help. And I don't know why. I really don't know why no one helped him. That's a serious problem, Lisa Abiola. You're right. And he kept going. Because people have lost their humanity, someone says. They want him to fumble.
This is part of the Don Lemon weekly podcast. It's something he calls Lemon Drops. And sometimes he does them in the morning, sometimes he doesn't, during different parts of the day, depending on what his topics are. So be sure to check him out on a regular basis. This is another example of some of the different things that are going on in Black America and with Ebony Spectrum as we look around the globe and give you some thoughts from our fellow broadcasters and ourselves. Thanks for listening.
The life of every child is precious beyond measure. If you care for a child with a disability and have limited income and resources, help is available. Children with a physical or mental disability or who are blind may qualify for monthly cash payments through the Supplemental Security Income Program, or SSI. The program provides help to meet basic needs for food, clothing, or a place to live, and disability-related needs. It's money that can make a meaningful difference. If you're the parent or caregiver of a child or teenager you think may be eligible, call Social Security at 1-800-772-1213 or visit ssa.gov/SSIKids to learn how to apply today. That's ssa.gov/SSIKids. It's real help for the children. Message produced by Social Security at U.S. taxpayer expense.
Ever lose your keys? Is that normal aging, dementia, or something else? Fear often stops us from asking for a simple checkup from the neck up. Knowing your numbers, blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol are common, but your cognitive numbers are also important, especially if you're age 65 or older. Better to act sooner rather than later if you want to maintain or enhance your brain's health. Hello, I'm Kevin, president of the Dementia Society of America, a national nonprofit organization. I'm excited to offer you a free guide filled with tips for better brain health and important facts about dementia, care planning, and much more. Go to 1-800-DEMENTIA.org or call 1-800-DEMENTIA. Your brain will thank you.
WRCT.org. WRCT Pittsburgh.
WRCT 88.3 FM. My name's Anthony Cachado, and you're listening to The Angry Young Man. Now, before we get into the mix of things today, just wanted to let you guys know that everything that you're going to hear today is strictly the opinions of myself and my guests today, and don't necessarily represent the views of WRCT. We're back. We're actually doing new episodes. I promise this is a thing. We're making it happen. And we have a guest today. We're actually talking about something interesting, or a couple interesting things today. We have a longtime friend of mine hailing from Texas. We have Gavin here with us today. Welcome to The Angry Young Man.
Hello.
Yeah, so, I mean, I had a couple things that would be interesting for us to talk about. I know there was something you wanted to talk about, but I've been reading what some may call the book of the year so far. I'm reading Abundance by Ezra Klein.
I have a copy of that.
You have a copy of that? I just now got a copy because they had, ironically, Abundance was not abundant for a period of time. I just got a copy of it. It's interesting because, you know, if for those of you who have listened to the show before, you'll know that I have a little bit of a fixation with housing. But it's interesting to see, you know, this argument for abundance liberalism and talking about using state capacity to kind of pursue growth and look at these things. I've only gotten about 30 pages into it so far. There's some things that I agree with. There's some things I disagree with. But I guess we'll start off this segment by kind of getting at that. I mean, Gavin, would you consider yourself an abundance liberal?
I'm not. I don't know. I guess I agree with the idea. I don't know.
I mean,
how would you define abundance liberal? And we'll go from there.
Well, I find it kind of the defining factor that separates it, the abundance liberal from, say, you know, the free market absolutist or fundamentalist, is the idea that there's a necessity to use state capacity to go after both supply and demand. I mean, they look at it as, and they open in the book by saying that, you know, for so long because the fundamental kind of crux of economics is supply and demand, how it's been divided in half, and each side of the political spectrum has kind of made one of those their baby, in the sense that the right has been entirely supply focused and the left has been entirely demand focused. And, you know, the lack of understanding that both have their own importance because they are supply and demand, not just supply or just demand. They kind of advocate for the, you know, the pushing of both to go about things. I mean, I have my fair share of disagreements kind of going out the gate with some of the claims, specifically as they relate to using state capacity to push for a lot of these things or to subsidize demand. Or to look for some of those things. They may be addressed later in the book. I haven't gotten just far into it just yet. But I mean, I'm curious. To what degree do you subscribe to those sorts of claims? And if so, what's your critique of say the market fundamentalist approach that I'm sure you know you're aware that I hold on this matter.
Yeah, I'd say. In all things, in housing, which is our first topic, in food and water, there we have, I guess, the title of the book. We already have a superabundance of all of these things. We have enough where if we had the perfect allocation of resources, a perfect system, nobody would ever starve. Because we have more food than anyone could eat. We have more housing. We have more homes than homeless people. All of these things. So we're at a point now where it's not really a matter of how do we grow food? How do we have more houses? How do we have enough for everyone to survive? Which is what most of human history was about. And we now are at a point of, okay, how do we think about our systems to have them structured in such a way that everyone... has enough. And I think that's kind of where we should be going forward as a society at this point. So especially in terms of housing, I don't think we should accept homeless people as a concept at all. And if that means somebody has like a homeless shelter, that's like a little studio apartment, then that's what that is. I think you should be given the bare minimum. And I think beyond that, if you want to work for something harder, absolutely. Like even, and this is where I'm going to lose people, but like even if you're like a drug addict and you want to be in your home all day doing drugs, I don't think you should have a particularly good quality of life. I don't think, because you're not contributing to society at all. But I don't think it's very ethical to say somebody should die. In that circumstance, just should be on the street and have no societal support. And it's not even like an ethical thing. Like homeless people are a drain on society as they exist. If they overdose, that's a drain on our medical system. If they live in like a northern climate, Pittsburgh, whatever, and it's the winter and they have pneumonia or frostbite or whatever. I don't know. I'm from Texas, so I don't know what happens when you get cold. It's a mystery. That's also a drain on the medical system. If they do a crime because they're so desperate and hungry and they have to go to prison, that's a drain on our prison system. So I think overall, you can even make an argument that just housing these people would be a cost-saving measure for society, for taxpayers overall. So that's sort of my position.
So, I mean, one of the kind of key things I want to zone in on, no pun intended, is... you know, you mentioned, you know, the crisis of homelessness, and something that they bring up very quickly in the section on at the outset is this idea of, you know, why do we have homelessness? Why does this happen? And you know, they kind of zone in on the fact that more often than not, it's a cost issue, you know, in terms of how much the homes cost. And you know, in a lot of ways, I don't necessarily agree that we have enough housing or an abundance of housing. That, you know, at least in our metropolitan areas, there's not an abundance in the sense that we're able to address the massive demand of these areas. You'll look at states like California and New York that have been historically and notoriously bad at trying to address these issues with their zoning policies. I mean, you can drag in redlining if you really wanted to, but you know, there it kind of falls down on this issue of There's this strand of liberal policy which has attempted to restrict supply, and as a result has caused the crisis of homelessness, because all of these other things that we look at as a result, where you have the drug epidemic as a result, or turning to violence, these are symptoms of the problem, not necessarily the problem in of themselves. So, I mean, at least coming from my part of things, you know, you can address the cost issue at no cost by pulling back on a lot of these regulations that states like California and New York have been putting so much effort into holding up, and or at least have felt the pressure from the NIMBYs in their respective communities to uphold these regulations, which, quite frankly, it doesn't really cost anything materially outside of maybe the administrative cost of just kind of keeping the lights on while you're debating it. You know, for you to roll back these things, and you already experience so much change from there that, you know, it's an ambiguous amount of change. You know, how much are you going to make a dent in the homeless population? How much are housing prices going to fall down? But you could look at some pretty good case examples. You know, in your home state of Texas, I believe it was Austin that just recently saw rents tumble about 20% because the housing stock went up. You know, and it ultimately falls down to, you know, can you allow the market to address demand? I mean, if you're getting rid of these artificial caps, that should do enough in of itself. And then you kind of ask the question, well, is it necessary for us to start subsidizing demand again? On your front of things, it would appear that your position to an extent requires some amount of subsidizing demand, or you know, doing some sort of subsidy to allow for access to housing. So I'm curious if that, you know, how that would play out, and to what degree the government or state capacity to act would be necessary if you were able to pull back on just the caps on supply.
Yeah, so just to re-clarify my position, like, obviously right now, like, there's not, there is a lot of cities where the housing situation is so far not great, not conducive to, like, universal housing. You know, how do I put this? Like you were saying, like, rents are exorbitantly high in Los Angeles and New York. But I think my position is this is not like a human economic. Like, we have the labor capacity, we have the technology to build enough homes for everyone to live, just simply, just as simple as that. So then the question becomes, why don't we have that? And yeah, I think you adequately addressed some of these issues. A lot of it, well, all of it is just policy issues, basically. Some of it might be like cultural or whatever, but I feel like the vast majority is policy. These are policy decisions that are very deliberately put in place. A lot of it is like the YIMBY NIMBY debate. We know. I was going to pick up Austin myself because it's an example I'm well aware of. It's right in my neighborhood, so to speak. You know, Austin has grown so much. You can look at a skyline picture of, like, Austin in 2015 versus Austin today, and it's like, it looks like a different city. And this isn't like because nobody wants, like rents are also super low in Austin. And there's, like, two sides of that. There's supply and demand. And one might be tempted to say, well, nobody wants to live in Austin, but that's just not the case. You know, you ask anybody in Houston.
Do you want to live in Austin?
I'd like to. Like, everyone wants to live in Austin. Austin's the cool place to live. It's like the LA of Texas. Like, people want to go there. So it's clearly not like a low demand thing. It's, they're doing something right. I think they've enacted good policies. Houston has done similar things. They have very, very notoriously soft zoning policies. So there's that, obviously. I think you would have to have a very strong state capacity if you wanted to like provide a universal layer of guaranteed homelessness. But I think it is possible. I think a really good example of this is Japan. Japan is a country of how like almost a billion people, right?
A good amount.
I don't know.
Not off, yeah. I don't know off the top of my head, but yeah, you, so.
Maybe like, okay, 100 million. Okay, not nearly as much as I thought, but.
A lot of people. We'll put it that way.
They have in their entire country about 2,000 homeless people. And this is like in Tokyo. Like if there was a city in the size, if there was a city the size of Tokyo in the US, there would be like a bajillion homeless people. So clearly like Japan is doing something right. And I think a big thing is that they have a pretty generous a welfare system there that kind of just doesn't accept homelessness as this thing. And I think a lot of it in Japan is also a cultural thing. Like this culture of there's a very, very strong stigma around homelessness and also like around hospitality. But I think a lot of it is like statewide decisions on the part of a government to support like very strong housing policies, because Tokyo is another place that has notoriously very low rents for a city of its size.
Well, I think you can look
and
at
Tokyo also has very, very, you know, not great houses, but like these tiny, tiny little condos that people have.
Yeah, and that's
I think
kind of...
that's fine. That's great. That beats living on the street.
Yeah.
So that's the kind of things that I would want. I would want like not a great quality of housing, because obviously like cost is a worry, but like anything's better than people living on the streets.
Yeah.
So if there's a way to do this with like it being entirely free market, I would like that. But so far, I haven't seen a good case of this being done like entirely through market forces and market incentives. So just to go back to your question, yeah, I think you would have to have a pretty strong government program for this to work.
I guess the one thing, and I will kind of pivot from there, is, you know, in the case of Japan, they have extreme, especially Tokyo, extreme density. Which allows, uh-huh. you know, is a supply thing. They have enormous supply.
Sure.
I mean, maybe it's not the best supply. You mentioned that, you know, they're not the best apartments, but it's supply nevertheless, which allows, you know, rents to go down like that. You know, there was a lot to consider, I guess, very briefly, because I know there's a bigger topic we want to get to. While we're on the topic of other nations, you know, immigration never ceases to be a topic of interest. I know we have very many overlapping positions on this, but I guess the thing I wanted to probe you on a little bit was as it relates to the illegal nature of crossings, you know, be it for someone who's you know, either of ill intent or not. I guess, you know, because we definitely agree, you know, there needs to be reform in the system as it relates to making it easier to immigrate. But as it relates to people who do come illegally, if you do go about treating it as a criminal offense, being that it you know, it is a crossing that is not legal. So I'm curious to probe your thoughts on that, especially being from a border state. Kind of very briefly what you think.
I have to organize my thoughts for a second. Sorry. I feel like when we call it like this illegal, like it moralizes it a lot that they've done some big crime. And I just don't see illegal things as necessarily morally bad things, you know. You can imagine a situation like a mother stealing food for her starving kids. I don't see that as morally bad. And a lot of the times, this illegal immigration is a similar thing. It's these people in very, very desperate situations, so desperate that like I can't even imagine having to make some of these decisions. I know in the case of a very famous case recently of I'm not sure exactly what his name is. I think it's Kilmar Abrego Garcia.
It's the Venezuelan gentleman.
El Salvadorian.
Oh, sorry. We're jumping between El Salvador and Venezuela so much right now in the news. Get the streams crossed. But yes.
He was coming to the United States because a gang back in El Salvador was threatening the life of him and his family. And he came here and he worked in the United States. He has a pretty good paying job. He's contributing to the economy. He's paying taxes. He's buying local goods. He has a family. He has a wife who's an American citizen. He has a kids here. And even though, yes, he came here illegally originally, I'm not comfortable saying he's any less American than you and me. And so it's sort of a case-by-case basis like that. If they're coming here to do terrible things, then obviously I'm not happy with that. If they're here to do crimes, if they're here to smuggle drugs, that's not great. But I don't think that's the vast majority of the people who are being deported right now. So I think you'd have to deal with that on a case-by-case basis, decide, is this person well integrated in the American society and the American economy? Are they contributing to our economy? And did they come here under a situation of distress? I think those are all considerations you have to make in these cases. And I think more often than not, I would like these people to stay here because it is a good thing for immigrants to be here, and it's very difficult for them to come here right now.
Yeah, and I think that's the crux of where we have a lot of our agreement. That, you know, I think we both agree it should be easier to come here. You know, I definitely hold the sentiment that it is a good thing to have immigrants in this country. I mean, I wouldn't be here right now if it weren't for the fact that my grandparents came here as recently as the 1960s. So, you know, I definitely have.
Neither of us are Native Americans, I don't think. Imagine. I don't think most of the people listening are 100% Native Americans, so we're all immigrants.
And I think, you know, kind of where the thing I wanted to kind of zero in on is, you know, you bring up the point of, say, you know, a mother who steals bread. You know, we show compassion in those cases where we review the violation of the law. I'm curious to what extent do we provide, say, slaps on the wrist, because mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you're still talking about, irrespective of the fact that, you know, potentially there's a moral good or even maybe a moral ambiguity, you know, there is a law that's broken, and I think that's, you know, the kind of the key core and principle thing here. To what extent do you exercise grace, and to what extent do you go about the upholding of the law? So I mean, you know, it's a lot to kind of touch on, but unfortunately we cap ourselves to 30 minutes here, and you know, restrain the you know, free flow of intellectual debate. But I know, you know, there was the one thing that you wanted to get to, and I definitely want to make sure we had some time to speak about it. You wanted to speak about gender. I would assume this is of a broad kind of heady general, what do we think here? But I'm, is there something specifically that you wanted to touch on?
So this is for a class project of mine, obviously. So I wanted to get your opinion on this. So there's this sort of model of three different models of marriage. So there's this idea of a traditional marriage. This is what you imagine, like the housewife. You know, the wife typically doesn't work. If she does, it's like maybe a part-time job. She does the majority of the housework, the majority of taking care of kids. And then there is this neo-traditional model. Let's hold that thought. Let's go to the opposite end. There's this progressive model where this is what like a very egalitarian person would advocate all marriage should look like. You know, equal both the mother and the father are breadwinners. You know, they might have roughly equal incomes, and they split housework, they split caring for the kids equally amongst them. And then there's this neo-traditional model, which is a bit of a mix of the two, of this, basically the mother does work, but she also does the brunt of the housework of the taking care of the kids. And I wonder, of those three models of marriage, which of those would sound the most appealing to you? Which of those you believe not our society should be structured on, but which do you believe you would want your ideal marriage to look like?
Oh, this is interesting. We're breaking from the politics here on the show, which is cool, I guess.
Let's say scaling it down to a microscopic level.
I guess we can say that. I mean, listen, I'm... in many ways, I'm an old school guy. You know, that's just the kind of world I grew up in. More often than not, the type of people of my background gravitate towards the neo-traditional in a lot of ways. Because I think this is also informed in a lot of ways by my faith. I definitely think, you know, as a Catholic, you know, there's this in conception of marriage, we define, you know, separate but equally important roles for both the man and the woman in the relationship. And I think, you know, this is kind of the thing that's lost on a lot of people when they look at the Catholic or, you know, even generally Christian conceptions of marriage between a man and a woman, because it's, you know, obviously there are certain things that both the man and the woman have going on for their respective roles in the marriage, but they are of equal importance and there's equal accountability between both halves to hold up their end of the bargain. I don't think that the neo-traditional model really deviates much from that, from the traditional, in so much as it still maintains kind of the core essence of what's going on with some, you know, realities that kind of reflect back on potentially some of the socioeconomic factors we have to kind of put into consideration for a lot of families that are currently trying to make ends meet and need to live on two incomes. I mean, I can tell you it's definitely not easy in New York to afford to live there when the median households the median house price selling in my home county is almost $750,000. It's ludicrous. So, you know, I can say that I would kind of bounce between the two. But, you know, obviously as a libertarian, so long as you're not hurting other people, I'm very much of the opinion that you, you know, pursue the model that works for you. But I'm curious then, you know, is there any kind of further consideration from that you wanted to touch on? Or, where you personally kind of fall on that? Where does that kind of pan out for you?
So for me personally, obviously, I'm a very progressive person, so I think that's the type of model I would want. I would want sort of shared responsibility, both parents having relatively equal static income levels. And this is sort of the environment I was raised in. My parents, sometimes some would lean a little bit more, but generally I feel like both my mom and my dad had a very big role in raising me. So I'm curious, you said that in your faith, both the men and the women have these separate but equally important roles. So I'm curious, what would you conceive as the role for the man in a marriage?
I mean, he's ultimately the primary provider, you know, and this kind of falls back into, you know, sure, there can be, you know,
so like kind of this breadwinner role.
Yeah. And you know, at the same time, you know, the woman, you know, can, and she has the desire to do so, should pursue, you know, a source of income as well. But, you know, the conception is, you know, that there's the primary role in the part of the man to do so, being kind of the ultimate defender of the family, things of that sort, you know, which is mirrored in a lot of ways by the nature of men and women in just kind of how the there's a kind of attitude of what manhood is and what womanhood is that's presented through the Bible, which mm-hmm. you know it doesn't mean that it's kind of cut and dry. This is the case. I mean, you know, obviously we're not, you know, from the perspective of faith, we're all made in God's image, but we have varieties upon which that is different. But you know, there's kind of broad generalizations that encompass certain deviations as well that just are brought forth by the Bible. And I did actually do a very interesting Bible study a while back on you know, mm-hmm. what does the Bible say about manhood? What does it mean to be a man? What are the virtues inherent to masculinity? We're kind of in the last minute here. I mean, any kind of closing thoughts there that you wanted to bring in?
No, this has been really, really great. A good conversation, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean,
I don't know if you feel the same way.
Absolutely, yeah. I think, you know, it's always so crazy how fast the time goes. You know, it makes
it is. Yeah, I was very surprised about that.
it makes you yearn for the days of ye old tavern. You know, the coffee. Coffee, but whatever you wanted, the salon. So, but anyways, thank you for coming on. It was a pleasure to have you, and I hope you guys enjoyed having, you know, an actual guest on the show once again. But